Hello, I'm David Malscrop. Welcome to Open to Debate. A few weeks back, we spoke with Tiffany Balducci about the Alberta NDP leadership race. This week, we're keeping on the Alberta theme, but instead of looking ahead, we're looking back. You may have forgotten Jason Kenney. After his dismal leadership review, the former Harper-era cabinet minister resigned as Premier of Alberta and left politics. But Kenney's legacy continues to shape the country. A new book assesses his career, its effect, and the state of the right in Canada. So who cares about Jason Kenney? My guest on this episode of Open to Debate is Jeremy Appel, an Alberta-based journalist and author of Kenneyism, Jason Kenney's Pursuit of Power. Let's start with why. And why write a book about Jason Kenney? And I know you've got a good answer to this. And I've seen this come up. People say, well, why Jason Kenney? And I've just been so excited to ask you this because I really like your answer. So that spoils the question a little bit, but I don't care. So why write a book about Jason Kenney?
Kenney is, in my mind, one of the most influential conservative Canadian figures in my lifetime. I would put him up there with Stephen Harper, of course, Mike Harris, Ralph Klein, Preston Manning. I would say he was even more influential than Manning because he took a lot of Manning's ideas and sort of was instrumental in bringing them into the mainstream. And I think if we look at the trajectory of conservative politics in Canada over the past 30 years, Kenney really stands at this nexus of this Reaganite, Thatcherite, neoconservatism. And also what you see now with this more pseudo-populist right with Pierre Poilievre and Danielle Smith and Doug Ford. And yeah, I mean, he really stands at the nexus of that. And I think the contradictions between those styles of conservatism, which ultimately serve the same purpose, which I think we'll probably get into in a bit, are ultimately what brought him down.
So I definitely want to get into that, but I want to pick up on something you just said because I think it's really important. I mean, Kenney was a successful politician and he was a consequential politician. And one of the things I liked about this book, and there were a bunch of things I liked, but one of the things I liked about this book was that it's not just a book narrowly about Jason Kenney. It's not a deep dive into every last biographical detail, although there's a little bit of that. It's a book about Kenneyism, Kenney, and the right in Canada, the past and the present, and to some extent, the future of the right in Alberta and in Canada more generally, which I think is really important. So did you, when you set out to write this, were you thinking, I'm going to write about Kenney and the right? Or was it in the process of writing about Kenney that you realized how much he had shaped the right?
That's an excellent question. I think when I set out to write this book, as a book does, it evolves from when you sign your contract and have your proposal accepted. And as you're writing it, you really like hone its analysis. And I was privileged to have a lot of really smart people, people much smarter than myself.
That's the trick.
That's how you do it. Drafts of chapters, like each chapter I kind of sent to a different person who I thought knew a lot about that topic. When I had proposed the book, it was essentially Kenney's been around a while. He was a very influential figure in conservative politics. And I knew I didn't want to be a conventional biography, right? That's not my style. Right? I mean, If they're writing an authorized biography of someone, which are obviously the most detailed ones, or tend to be the most detailed ones, you shouldn't. You know, if you're getting access to that person, it's for a reason.
Yes.
And, I mean, I tried to get a hold of Kenney. I didn't try too hard because, frankly, I don't think that is the most important part of his story, is what he thinks of everything.
Mm-hmm.
In Canadian conservative thought, in broader global conservative thought, I had a few publishers turn down my proposal, but give me really valuable feedback, including one person that, I mean, I submitted to the university, the proposal to the University of Alberta Press, and the guy there, he was like, this is great. I'm really excited about it. Not for us, because it's not very academic, but here are some critiques I have. And other publishers also got back to me with critiques that basically said, you need to situate him as part of this broader conservative movement, that this isn't just about Jason Kenney, because who cares?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, there are some interesting things about him as a person that I do think add to his uniqueness as a political figure, but ultimately he's part of something a lot bigger. And going back and reading old newspaper articles from when, like, one quote stands out to me. He was at the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, but he was clearly Reform was trying to get him to run for them. And he was at this Winds of Change conference in Calgary, co-hosted by Ezra Levant and David Frum. In 1996, so the year before he ran for Reform. And it was just all these conservative heavyweights from largely Reform, but some PCs were there too, just talking about how do we create this like unified conservative movement to remove the Liberals from power and maintain our vision of this conservative Canadian society while making ourselves electable. And that was sort of the key challenge there, among others. But there was a great quote from Kenney in a Globe and Mail piece that covered the conference, in which he said that if you look at the United States, there's a movement consciousness, in his words, among conservatives there. We don't have that in Canada. And Kenney, of course, as you know, because you read the book and it's been reported on elsewhere, primarily by Taylor Lambert in The Sprawl, he was part of this conservative movement when he was a student at the University of San Francisco, never finished his degree, but he did cause a ruckus on campus and was part of the movement off campus to overturn San Francisco's domestic partnership law. That was the first in the United States, but then of course it being America, they did overturn it, right? They had a referendum and the no side won, but then like a few years later, they had another referendum and the yes side won. So, but I think that really, that experience of living in the States, which is really when he transformed into this really profoundly conservative ideologue. And I think that is what makes Kenney unique from a lot of conservative politicians in Canada, is that he's done his homework. Like, he knows his stuff. A lot of what he knows isn't true, but he is very immersed in the ideology in a way that someone like Doug Ford isn't.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, Doug Ford hasn't
there's
read.
There's no there.
Yeah. Like, he, you know, he hasn't read Ludwig von Mises, I doubt, or like John Locke, or, you know, all these like great thinkers.
There's no way Doug Ford knows who either of those people are.
Yeah.
There's zero.
Why would he?
Yeah. 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 Which brings you to the question, what is Kenneyism? Because you mentioned that this isn't a typical biography, and it's not. You said the guy from the University Press said this wasn't really an academic book. I read it as a fairly academic book in the best sense of the word, insofar as it is grounded in broadly in literature. It is written accessibly, but with a depth and precision that I think often reflects the best of academic writing. So it was a really well balanced book, and it all hinges on the thesis that there is a thing called Kennyism, and that it is a very particular brand of politics. So we'll get into the subjects that you mentioned earlier, some of the substantive bits in a sec. But in the meantime, what specifically is this Kennyism, and where does it come from?
Right. So Kennyism has a lot of components to it. I would say one part that is very much emblematic of the modern right is the combination of offloading the responsibilities of the state onto individuals or charities or churches or families and whatnot, right? Neoliberalism, while also strengthening the strong arm of the state to essentially protect property rights, right? I mean, this is neoliberalism, and neoconservatism provides shape to it through this project that is patriotic. It reveres traditional sources of authority that provide these empty vessels to endow this otherwise cold materialistic project with a higher purpose, and is very militaristic abroad, but manifests itself at home, which is most of the focus of the book, as the sort of law and order, cops and robbers style of criminal justice policy. Or in Kenny's case, of course, which straddles sort of the at home and abroad immigration policy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a crucial aspect of Kennyism as well. This conditional acceptance of immigrants and other ethnocultural groups that were seen as outside the conservative fold previously were certainly seen as outside the reform fold, because the Reform Party was originally anti-immigrant.
Mm-hmm. Anti-multicultural, anti...
Yeah. And Kenny was like, hang on a sec. A lot of these immigrants and other, especially religious communities, have the same values as conservatives. At least elements within these communities do. And so we can reach out and bring these people into the conservative fold, the sort of elites in these communities, and also just show up to their events and get for the rank and file people who may not be as ideological, just to make our presence as conservatives known and bring them in to this, what John Carlaw, the York University PhD who coined the term Kennyism, describes as neoconservative multiculturalism. So it takes this liberal cultural mosaic sentiment and uses it to promote policies that are at their core exclusionary, right? When we look at how Kenny treated asylum seekers, for example, which is deport them, like, right. They get, right? He and maybe we can get into this a bit more, but basically when he was citizenship and immigration minister, he created two tiers of asylum seekers. The new tier, which was people from countries that essentially Canada was geopolitically aligned with, like Mexico and Eastern European countries. And gave them, people from this list of countries he drafted, one opportunity to hear their asylum case at the Immigration and Refugee Board. And if they were denied, their only avenue of appeal would be through federal court, but they had to leave the country immediately. And you also saw this with temporary foreign workers and other disproportionately racialized communities. That he at the same time was cultivating into the conservative fold. And then lastly, the last component of Kenyism, and I think this is integral to understanding his demise, is the use of this populist framing to uphold a project that is at its core elitist. And this goes back to his days with the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, right? Just talking about how we, the people, are standing up to these special interests who are just getting government money to do nothing. And that's why we need to reduce, fundamentally alter the role of government in society in a way that just so happened to make a very small amount of people really wealthy and everyone else increasingly dependent upon the whims of the wealthy.
And we're going to come back to this in a little bit, because in a very Greek, tragic way, this will end up being Kenny's downfall, which I think that is really fascinating. I have to say, the whole book to me was fascinating. And I've mentioned this publicly, and I've mentioned to you that I really quite enjoyed it. But the last 5 or 6 pages are the best pages in the entire book, because it captures so well what this setup of the previous 290 pages, whatever it is, ends up delivering. And it does, it reads like Sophocles in the last 6 pages, but we'll get there in a second. First though, I'm curious about how the reception has been, because we've talked about this again publicly. I don't think the book has been getting as much mainstream coverage as it deserves. That was one of the reasons I was so keen to have you on. That was one of the reasons I'm writing a review of it right now. You know, if this had been written by, I said this on Twitter, if this had been written by a legacy columnist, it would be everywhere. And it, you know, a year from now, it would be up for every award. It, by the way, this, it still may be, you know, the 2025 ones are going to cover the books just released now. So who knows where we're going to be a year from now. But I'm curious how the reception and the coverage has been, and what your experience has been so far since it's come out in February.
Well, people who have read the book, who I know and respect, all seem to have really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And it's not, it's just...
Because it's good. Well, I just want to say that because I, you know, it is a very good book. I was reading it and I wanted to live tweet it, because there were just every couple of pages, I'm like, oh my God, people need to know this. I need to remember this. Like, it was just so powerful. So I'm sorry for cutting you off, but I just wanted to let readers know, in case I haven't got that point across yet, it's a very good book.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess the first indication of how the book was getting received was, of course, the endorsements. I asked a bunch of people to do, not just people who are like firmly on the left, like us and Luke Savage and Nora Loretto, but also people who I would say are much closer to the center, like academics, such as Jared Wesley at the University of Alberta and the aforementioned Lisa Young at University of Calgary. And I was really flattered by the feedback I got from the people I asked for endorsements, and that this wasn't, that I wasn't only preaching to the choir. I mean, to some extent I am, because if you're a Danielle Smith supporter who hates Kenny, you're not going to like the reasons I outline for why Kenny had this pernicious influence on Canadian politics. And if you like Kenny, I mean, obviously you're not going to be interested in what I have to say about him. But so that was really heartening. When the book came out, I mean, again, like, people I know, people in my orbit who have read it, loved it, and said really flattering things about it. If you go on Goodreads, there are a couple people who I would say are in the categories I just described of either Kenny loyalists or people to the right of Kenny, who, to their credit, appear to have read the book, not very closely, but they read it and hated it. And I was heartened by that, right? Because if only people who like your book are reading it, then it's not reaching a large audience, right? Yeah.
And you're probably not saying anything important, right? I mean, you could write a detailed biography that makes no substantive claim, but what's the point of that? Well, I want to dig into substance now, the book has a thesis. It explores Kennyism as a concept. It also goes in detail through very particular policy areas in which Kenny was involved, both federally as minister and provincially as premier, as opposition leader and premier. And so it talks about immigration, education, healthcare, labor, the pandemic. Way too many for us to go through one by one because there's so much in there. But I'm curious, in the course of your research, whether there was anything that stood out as particularly notable as a failure or success. Let's be fair, there were some successes to some extent when it comes to Kenny's record. Because for me, his handling of the pandemic and his time as immigration minister and what he did on that file really stood out as the two big Claxon initiating sections. But I'm curious on your end if there's any particular moments or policies that really stand out to you as notable.
Well, if you go back to his time as Canadian Taxpayers Federation executive director, I was surprised to learn the extent to which he was taken seriously by people in positions of power. I mean, Paul Martin called him up and was like, "All right, Jason, how can I reduce the deficit and not raise taxes?" And it's like, I don't know why you needed to call someone for that advice. But that to me, and also the sort of contrast between this very uncritical media coverage he got and sort of where he honed this real media savvy that he had, that I think he lost a lot of when he came back to Alberta, but particularly during the pandemic. And the fact that these rallies that were like being depicted in, you know, the Southam papers, which are now post-media, and the Sun papers, which are also now post-media, and also even in the Globe as this like revolutionary moment, weren't really that big. He wasn't like these big Canadian Taxpayers Federation rallies that were being held in the 90s didn't really attract that many people. I mean, Lethbridge had a huge event, which I think tells you a lot about Lethbridge, though Lethbridge is an interesting place because it's also got a university and it's a small city. Ottawa, I mean, I forget the number, but it was like embarrassing how few people you could get to turn out to an anti-tax rally in Ottawa. But it didn't matter because the elites, the very elites he was constantly raging against, were like, yeah, this guy is a point. We should listen to him. And I don't want to make it sound like Kenny was like pulling the strings behind, 90s austerity. Of course, there were much more powerful forces at play, like the IMF.
The bond market.
Yeah. But he was in the right place at the right time and had a gift, I think, for... like the current premier of Alberta, just spinning bullshit with utmost confidence and gravitas. And that to me was interesting. But of course, he wasn't actually making the decisions. When it comes to actually governing with the Conservative Party of Canada, he made a lot of changes to the immigration system that are intact, largely. I mean, the worst aspects of it, so what I mentioned before about the two-tiered asylum-seeking process, Supreme Court of Canada ruled that was unconstitutional, so Trudeau got rid of it. He infamously cut healthcare benefits to asylum seekers, which also was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court and reversed by Trudeau. But a lot of the underlying framework that he built remains intact.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Canada's still, the temporary foreign worker program is a total disaster. And I mean, Kenny didn't invent the temporary foreign worker program, though he did increase use of temporary foreign workers, a small portion of which are part of the official temporary foreign worker program. There are other programs to bring in temporary foreign workers. There's really offloading our immigration system onto the market. I mean, you see that now. That, I mean, in the way that we're talking about immigration and that the housing crisis is totally in line with this paradigm that Kenny ushered in, that saw asylum seekers and immigrants and temporary foreign workers and permanent residents as economic units of measurement and not people. And I think Harun Siddiqui at the Toronto Star, about a decade ago, when Kenny was near his end of his tenure at Citizenship and Immigration, and then he was transferred to employment, he described Kenny as the Canada's chief headhunter for business. And I think that really succinctly explains a significant part of immigration policy under Kenny. There's also the citizenship guide that he rewrote and totally turned it into this ideological tribute to the virtues of the British Crown and Westminster parliamentary democracy and the Canadian military, and talked about barbaric cultural practices, a phrase that would come back to haunt the Harper government in 2015, under a picture of a woman in a niqab. And this made it, I mean, having this really ideological document to inform people who are newly coming to Canada of these really like high concepts of like rights and responsibilities did, I think, serve a function of socially engineering the cohort of people who would be accepted for Canadian citizenship, people who are proficient enough in English or French to be able to understand these concepts in that language, right? People who are more educated, which tend to be people who are higher income. And that basic structure remains intact, as well as the different treatment of different categories of newcomers. When you have asylum seekers who are dealt with to the letter of the law versus all these people who are getting fast-tracked to permanent residency because they work in a prescribed field, that the market, the gods of the market, demand. And I think you see this disparate treatment of different types of newcomers manifest itself now with how we've treated Ukrainian refugees. And I think that has, that should be a model for how we treat all refugees, is welcome to this country. We will do as much as we can to accommodate you. And then you look at how Sudanese refugees, and especially Palestinian refugees, are being treated. It's being made impossible for them to actually come to the country. And particularly in the case of refugees from Gaza, I mean, they're essentially have to disprove that they're not terrorists before they're even accepted into this country. And even if they're accepted in this country, they have to get out of Gaza on their own. And so I think this connection between immigration policy and foreign policy was a big part of what Kenny was trying to do. And again, that continues today under Mark Miller.
Yeah, so there's no segue here. We're just going to shift and talk about Alberta now, because I want to spend some time on talking about what became, at least for now, the end of Kenny's political career. He played a huge role. He played a role, let's say, in uniting the right federally, in the 90s and into the 2000s. In a parallel, decades later, he plays a role in uniting the right. He drives uniting the right, in this case, in Alberta. He, as you discuss in the book, adopts an authoritarian populist stance or a faux populist stance. And when I was reading the book, I was thinking of Denholm Elliott's line in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. It's like, you're meddling with forces you can't possibly understand. And I was just thinking about, this shines through in the book, how Kenny is trying to create that sort of populist driver that will put him, that will unite the right, that will bridge the gap between the sort of centrist, respectable, reddish Tories and the more libertarian, freedom-first, Wildrose style folks, and try to keep them together. And for a moment it works, and then it doesn't. So, in brief, what's the story of his move to unite the right, and how does it ultimately undo him?
Right. So he comes to Alberta, right? The Harper government is turfed, and he makes a decision, a very fateful decision, seeing that there's an NDP government in Alberta that is in power because of divisions in the conservative movement in Alberta that were superficially identical to the ones he helped mend on the federal level. And rather than do what Pierre Poilievre did and was wait in the wings for 8 years while other conservative leaders tried and failed to unseat Trudeau, building this following, Kenny decided that he could go back to Alberta, unite the right, get rid of the NDP, get reelected as premier, and then fuck off back to Ottawa. But this arrogance that he presumed it would be so easy was another, I think, key element of his downfall. I mean, he came back to Alberta and it was like, look, I was a federal cabinet minister. I represented a riding in Calgary. I can win. And there was this tacit agreement he had with the Wildrose base first he took over the PC party because they had an opening for leader after being reduced from governing the province for 44 years to third party status. Obviously, they were looking for a change in leadership. But he ran for the leadership on a single note platform, which was uniting with the Wild Rose, right? He made this explicit. That was his pitch. And the tacit agreement with the Wild Rose base was that he would give them electoral viability and legitimacy, and they would give him their votes. And so he said, especially after he won the PC leadership and it came time to get both parties on side for a merger, he started sounding all the right notes. He knew this populist, quasi-libertarian, anti-federal government, borderline separatist, if not outright separatist crowd, wanted to hear, talking about these purported injustices of the structure of Confederation, and almost using like anti-colonialist language to talk about the federal government. All the same things Danielle Smith is harping on. And everyone knew it was a facade. This guy spent the past 20 years in Ottawa. He was part of the government that wrote the most recent equalization formula. But it didn't matter insofar as he could achieve power and cut their taxes. And fast forward to 2019, the merger of Wild Rose and PC succeeds. He wins the UCP leadership under circumstances that until a month ago were under RCMP investigation. Surprise, no charges were laid, though the RCMP admitted there were at least some cases of fraud. And he wins. I mean, he really is. You listen to interviews with him now, and he talks about Trump and is just like, oh, that's not my style of conservatism. Don't know where that came from. But it was pretty obvious in these years he was really summoning the spirit of Trump and Brexit and this populist right, pseudo-populist right, I would say, which I would argue is not that different from the pseudo-populist right of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher and Preston Manning, but it's a whole other discussion. And he starts talking about how there's this environmentalist conspiracy against Alberta that the federal government and the NDP are part of, that is just trying to persecute Alberta and shut down the tar sands, even though it is the greatest, most moral source of oil in the world. And he wins in a landslide. It isn't even close, right? Oil prices had crashed right around the time the NDP got into power. I would argue that the NDP under Notley, particularly after its first year, lacked the sort of ambition to implement these bold policies that may have allayed some of the concerns of people who were laid off in the oil patch, that Kenney was able to cultivate into this authoritarian populist project by acknowledging that there is something that's fundamentally broken, as you see Pierre Poilievre doing. And the first series of things he does when he comes into government, he calls it the summer of repeat, right? And he lays out a plan to gradually roll back corporate taxes to lower than they were before the NDP took power, right? Where they are now, 8%, lowest in the country by far. He reverses a lot of the labor-friendly reforms the NDP made, chief among them raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, which at the time was the highest in the country. Now it's the second lowest. By not simply lowering the minimum wage, because people aren't going to like that. People who can vote and are likely to vote aren't going to like that. But creating this two-tiered minimum wage for youth and adults, with youth making $13 an hour. And there's a quote from Kenny that I think is amazing when he announced that and said, well, $13 an hour is a hell of a lot better. I think he said heck of a lot better, because he's Catholic, than $0 an hour. And that's the choice we have here, which is still stunning all these years later. He introduces a bunch of anti-labor legislation. And everyone in his caucus is united. They're happy. This is something that the more, as you say, respectable Tory establishment, right? And the less predictable populist libertarian, right, can agree on. And he, on other files, he makes it easier to start charter schools, which Alberta is the only province in Canada that has. And the NDP did nothing to even whittle away at their funding when they're in power. We also fund private schools upwards of 70%, despite the fact that they charge tuition, whereas charters don't. He forms this fair deal panel based in these grievances against Ottawa that he sends to travel across the province and essentially just let the separatist Wild Rose crowd blow off steam. This is a guy who like worships the British crown. I mean, he's not a separatist at all. But again, he was willing to play the part. But then the pandemic happens, and that is when these tensions begin to emerge. And Kenny really fails to show any sort of leadership by trying to appeal to everyone by dithering on imposing restrictions, but there are all these exceptions that render them largely ineffective, to removing the restrictions and saying COVID is just a mere influenza, and that everyone should take personal responsibility, to bringing back restrictions when things get really bad and lots of people are dying, and he dragged his feet for weeks and went on vacation, and then comes back and is saying, okay, here are some restrictions. They don't make any sense. You can't gather with friends outside, but you can go to a mall or you can go to church, which have capacity limits, but it's unclear who was enforcing that. There was enforcement against churches who were openly and defiantly violating these minimal restrictions, which the base really held against him to this day. You hear Danielle Smith talk about arresting pastors, right? Not mentioning what the pastors were doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. As if they're just being rounded up.
Yeah, it's religious persecution. And then starts opening up a bit in early 2021. Cases go up again. And he reverts back to the restrictions he introduced at the end of 2020 that don't make any sense. And this is when the rural part of his caucus are saying, and I found this interesting because Kenny's mantra during COVID was lives and livelihoods. We've got to protect both equally. And if you look at the actual material effects, it was livelihoods that were placed at the forefront of lives. If you look at the meatpacking industry during the first wave, that's evident. But there was a line in this open letter his rural caucus wrote to him that said, we need to protect our livelihoods and freedom. So lives isn't even part of the equation. And anyways, I know I'm droning on here, but it was precisely this rural base that turned on him for daring to impose even the most basic COVID restrictions. And those were the people who mobilized against him. Like Take Back Alberta, whose family, mm-hmm. David Parker, is a former Kenny staffer who drove across rural Alberta, riling people up who felt alienated during the pandemic. And a lot of these were communities that Kenny drove through on his Unity tour when he was in the process of uniting the right back in 2016, 2017. And the party mobilizes against him. His approval rating, at least according to the limited polling that was available at the time, was incredibly low. And that's where Danielle Smith comes in, sort of rises from the ashes and says, I will be everything Kenny claimed to be, but I actually mean it.
Which, and she seems to, right?
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff, like the religious right stuff, I don't think she actually believes that. That stuff, I think Kenny actually believes,
right,
but she's the one doing it because she knows which side of the bread to put her butter on.
Yeah.
But that's also when all this, it wasn't just COVID management, the bare minimum pandemic restrictions Kenny imposed that didn't mean. It was also the fact that he wasn't taking any action against Ottawa. He wasn't creating an Alberta pension plan. He wasn't creating an Alberta police force. These were all things he was delaying till later. He issued reports and just forgot about them. And there wasn't really any action. It was all rhetoric. And that was another aspect of Smith's appeal. It was like, I am going to threaten to separate, and we will never have a single COVID restriction, a single vaccine mandate again. The letter, which was easy for her to say because it was Kenny everyone else who just abandoned any public health policy in response to the Freedom Convoy.
We've got about 90 seconds left, so this is a bit of a complicated question, so you can just take your best stab at it if you want. But if the pandemic doesn't happen, is Jason Kenney still premier of Alberta today?
Yeah, 100%. And I think he would be doing a lot of things Danielle Smith is doing now, certainly around trans issues, because he believes that stuff. I mean, he's a devout Roman Catholic, which we haven't really got into, but is, I think, a big part of his social vision. I think he would take further steps towards separatism while still doing the act of, I am not a separatist. I love Canada. But a lot of people aren't, and I feel their pain, right? That was his whole shtick. I think he would have done that while also, because again, there was an election last year, right? And he would have had to mobilize the base in advance of that election. And there wouldn't have been that distrust as a result from his incoherent COVID policies that I think he would have had to take further steps on that file. I don't think he would have done the Alberta Sovereignty Act. That's one difference. I mean,
he called it out specifically, right?
He called it a cockamamie scheme.
Cockamamie.
But by Smith's own admission, it's pure theatrics. Like the first time it was invoked, right, about the clean electricity regulations, the law says, don't break, like, we're not instructing anyone to break the law. And it's like, well, then what's the point? And again, it's, and the reporter asked Smith about this at press conference. She's like, well, what do you think the Alberta Sovereignty Act was?
It pains me that we have to leave it there, but that brings us to time. There's so much more to talk about. We're going to have to talk about this again someday because there's a ton more to cover, but we've covered a lot today and I really appreciate it. I've mentioned it before. It's a great book. People should read it. It'll help you understand Kenny. It'll help you understand conservatism in Canada today, both in Alberta and across the country. And it's certainly an instructive read. Thanks again for joining me. This was fantastic.
Thanks for having me, David.
Entirely my pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
And that brings us to the end. And of course, into my thanks. My thanks to Jeremy, but also, as always, to Carolyn Smith, Ross Clark, and Aisha Jarrah, who make the show not just possible, but infinitely better than it would be without them. A reminder, the book is Kennyism, Jason Kenney's Pursuit of Power. It's available now wherever books are sold. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you back here in 2 weeks.